ARUP acknowledges the traditional owners across all lands, waters and skies the firm may reach. We acknowledge their wisdom, resilience and rich cultural heritage. We pay our respects to the elders past and present, and to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. We recognise the ongoing journey of healing and reconciliation, and ARUP commits to walking alongside First Nations peoples to acknowledge their teachings and foster a future of unity and respect. Welcome to ARUP's podcast, Sustainable Forces, a podcast about people joining forces to help solve some of the most complex sustainable development challenges. I'm your host, Dr. Michelle Dickinson. Water is life, and it brings with it an incredible sense of joy. From childhood puddle jumping to garden pool splashing, our best memories often flow through water. Water connects us to places, to people, culture, and moments in time. But our growing cities are putting a huge pressure on freshwater supplies, while creating more wastewater and stormwater than ever before. So here's a challenge. How do we meet soaring demand while managing the excess that we create? The answer may lie in circular thinking. Instead of the old linear model of use it, then dispose of it, what if our cities became water factories, capturing, reusing and transforming stormwater and wastewater into valuable new resources? To unpack this idea, I spoke with Chris Chesterfield, Professor of Practice at the Monash Sustainable Development Institute, and Celeste Morgan, ARUP's Integrated Water Management Leader in Melbourne. Together, we dive into what it takes to build circular water cities and how collaboration can create healthier, more sustainable urban waterways. Here's our conversation. Welcome to the podcast to kick things off. Chris, can you share a little bit about your background and your role at the Monash Sustainable Development Institute?
Sure, Michelle. I originally trained in botany and landscape ecology and somehow started working in the water sector, mainly in policy and planning roles, but then moved into more operational roles and worked at Melbourne Water at the general manager level and worked at CEO level in the water sector. And about 10 years ago, I moved across into the research space at Monash University, where I'm now a professor of practice at the Monash Sustainable Development Institute. My focus is really on, water system transformation, particularly from a governance and leadership perspective, and integrated urban and water planning. And, you know, really that focus, I guess, is how to advance those sort of water system transformations. You know, the sort of names we give them are circular water cities, integrated water management, water sensitive cities, and so on. So that's the sort of space I work in generally.
Amazing. Thank you. And Celeste, let's get to meet you. So tell us a little bit about your role at ARUP and maybe your experience in integrated water management, please.
Thanks, Michelle. Great to be here. I'm by training, I'm an environmental engineer, but I've also worked in, I guess, the planning and urban design space for my career. And that's the space I now lead at ARUP, what you call it, integrated water management. And that's really about how you thread together all parts of the water cycle to deliver shared outcomes for places and communities, and really embed that in how we design our cities and places so that we can all enjoy the benefits that water brings to our landscapes and our places.
That's great. So let's get into our topic. Today we're going to be talking about water circularity, especially in our cities. So we all remember when we went to school that there's a water cycle and we have evaporation and condensation and the rain comes down and eventually it froze to our rivers and our oceans and then goes back up. But that isn't the case, right, for our urban water systems. We've sort of disrupted this cycle with engineering. So can you chat a little bit, and Chris, I'll start with you, about what some of the challenges are that our cities face when it comes to our urban water systems?
Well, I think, you know, we've got urbanisation happening rapidly around the world, and that's, that's the same in Australia. We've got significant population growth going on in our cities, and really our cities rely very much on, you could say, ecosystem services for the provision of water services, and we've really sort of rapidly reaching the limits of the environment to sustain those services without incurring very significant damage, and declining livability in our cities. So I think that's part of the challenge in our conventional water practices, which tend to be very linear and siloed. You know, we harvest water, we treat it, we distribute it, and then we dispose of it through our wastewater systems. And similarly with stormwater, the water that falls on our cities, we collect and drain our urban landscapes and dispose of that stormwater either in combined sewer systems or through drainage systems that, you know, pollute and damage our waterways and coastal environments. And I think so there's that sort of challenge there, but I guess the other challenge is the way we've set up governance of our water systems, that we have, you know, policies and institutions that essentially do silo those different elements of the water cycle and very much focus on, individual services like water supply, wastewater, stormwater, rather than taking a holistic and integrated approach into the way we steward water in urban landscapes, essentially. So we've got both the sort of biophysical challenges, but we've got these governance challenges as well that are very hard to adapt and tend to embed these conventional approaches in the way that we work.
Yeah, thank you. We'll come back to some of those challenges in a second. Celeste, what do you think are some of the challenges that our urban water systems are facing?
Yeah, I think it's really helpful to think about how cities have evolved. Cities really are a nexus where a lot of the challenges come together. And because of how we've developed those in our history, I think we've learned to tackle those challenges individually. And we've set up a lot of the governance arrangements around that to be very singular in their objectives. So if you think about any city in the world, it usually came about because it's next to water, it's next to a coastline, it's next to a river, it's a source of transport and inspiration. People want to be near water. And the first challenge has always been, how do we get water? We need water for life, for living. And even, you know, the ancient Romans would build greater aqueducts to take a water source to a city. So that the initial focus was always on bringing water, often from faraway catchments, to supply. And that became one of the singular objectives. And then we discovered, oh, we're creating all this wastewater once we've used that water. We need sewage systems. And that became a very focus of getting that to work efficiently and sending that water back to the environment. And then we discovered, oh, we're getting far too big. There's too many people living here because of all these great services. We're creating all these impervious surfaces, roofs and roads, and the rainwater is running off. We need to drain these places, get rid of that water quickly. So then we ended up with water pollution issues. We ended up with flooding issues. And we set ourselves up to tackle all of these problems quite separately. So commonly in cities, you'll find there's one organization responsible for water supply, another for wastewater, another for stormwater management, and often some to manage the effects of flooding or waterway health. And that's really disconnected, I guess, the water cycle within cities. And often they don't really talk to city planners or urban designers in that equation either and rethink how we create those places.
So similar challenges, the lack of connection. Actually, we have an episode in Sustainable Forces called How Porous Is Your City? Talking about some of the challenges we have in our built-up environments. Before we get too deep into some of the challenges, let's talk about some of the positives around what you guys are interested in, which is circular thinking. And, you know, we know that the water cycle is circular. So is there a way that circular thinking can help us to reinstate our natural water systems?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the lens we're applying there is really the concept of a circular economy, which we're used to thinking about in terms of, I guess, materials and how we can recycle those or avoid waste. And I think it's an interesting question when you apply that to water in cities, where we do have these, I guess, large, you could call them waste streams, so wastewater and also stormwater running off our cities in large amounts. could we be doing more to capture those, to create that circularity rather than this kind of linear system of take, use, pollute, dispose? And so the principles of a circular economy, I guess, are to keep those materials within the system, so water within the city system, at its highest value. So how we define value is another question. And it's also how we regenerate the system, keep regenerating nature in that process. So I think it's a really useful model to think about how we can, you know, you put that water to the best use and keep it in the city to drive value again and again. Because we've set up these individual linear systems for water supply, wastewater, stormwater, which we've become very efficient at. But if you think about all of the waste we're creating, it's not very efficient at all. We have these resources there. We could be reusing them, capturing them, using them to supplement our water supply and drive value. So yeah, maybe Chris, you have some thoughts on how that can interact with our natural water systems.
Yeah, I think it's pretty hard to think about reinstating natural systems within cities if we think about, you know, reinstatement being going back to what we had before we built our cities where they are. But really the water circularity, integrated water management, water sensitive design, they represent ways of thinking of that's a philosophical shift, I guess, as Celeste was saying, a shift from traditional management practices that have really encouraged a sort of a linear one-way relationship in supply and consumption, treatment, discharge of urban water resources towards these sort of regimes that consider the whole or the interconnectivity of water and land use systems in decision making. And so while we can't necessarily reinstate nature as it was before we built our cities, we can put more nature more at the center of planning, design and operation of water systems in urban landscapes. We sort of, in terms of water circularity, we need to include nature in the circle. Essentially, because the way we've been working is that we have nature on at the sort of start that we extract from, and nature at the other end where we dispose to, and we don't think about nature being a beneficiary of the way we do services. We don't think about having a reciprocal relationship with nature, and of course, nature's it's what sustains us. So the more we degrade it, the bigger the problems we start to get into with our cities in so many ways.
So look, those are some of the challenges. We've talked about disconnection, different departments, siloed areas. We've talked about the fact that we're taking a natural resource but not necessarily considering nature as part of that context. So now I want us to move on to this idea that you have both introduced, which is a circular water city, I guess you'd call it, where, you know, you might capture stormwater and wastewater as well and reuse and repurpose them to add what we classed as value, and we can debate what we think value is rather than have it just go straight out to waste. So can one of you help me to understand what would you define as a circular water city? And then once we've defined it, how do we change what we currently have to actually move towards that direction?
Yeah, I think I'll talk about the city that we are living in, which is Melbourne in Australia. If we use that as an example, the water that Melbourne demands, I guess its community demands and needs, is a lot less than half than the water that it creates. So we're about 80 or 90% of the water that we bring into Melbourne exits again as wastewater. There's only a small proportion of that that's, you know, sunk into the ground as irrigation and is kept within the city. And stormwater, there's so much of it that runs off our city, which would have naturally infiltrated or evaporated. So we're actually dealing with a water abundance, and that's in a city that's on the driest continent in the world. Because we have this intensity of water functionality that happens within a city. So by making that circular, we need to think of new ways, I guess, to be capturing and reusing that abundance of water. And part of that can be supplementing our supply. So we could reduce the water that we draw from other catchments, from freshwater sources. And that could be simply using that water to flush your toilets, to water your garden, simple initiatives like having rainwater tanks to capture that, or larger initiatives like having localized wastewater treatment plants that then send that back. Or you can treat it to a standard, and some cities do, where you're actually using those supplies as your drinking water supply. So connecting the circle at a larger scheme. But because we have so much of that water, there's potential, I guess, to drive more value than just servicing the water needs, I guess, that a city traditionally has. So we could be using that water for urban greening to support our open spaces, our trees, and to re-inject that water into the landscape where it would have been to start with. We can use it to support new emerging water-hungry industries, potentially. Hydrogen or green hydrogen is a user of water. So, data centers are something that we wouldn't have imagined would be consuming a lot of water in our cities, but now they're on the horizon. There's new economies that can drive agriculture. You know, cities are an interesting, I guess, concept. If they are water generators, can we have that peri-urban productive landscapes where we're producing food for our cities, where our traditional growing areas are becoming drier? Could cities be the answer to the water crisis because we have this localized abundance of water that we could be recreating? So I think there's not necessarily the same roadmap for circularity in every city. It depends on what the needs are. But a circular city really makes a lot more use of those potential wastes and tries to reduce them and the impact they have on the environment while driving that value, whatever that key value may be in a city.
Yeah. I think every city is different. The context is different and circularity will be different in every city, but there's certainly going to be common principles and practices across all cities. And, you know, just thinking about, you know, modern cities, generally their water system services are provided by large centralized infrastructure. You know, it's a water supply system. Big dams might have desalination like ours. Increasingly, all capital cities in Australia now have desalination as well. And wastewater collection and treatment and disposal systems, it's big infrastructure worth billions and billions of dollars. But those systems aren't really linked. And I think, you know, part of what Celeste was really talking about there is, so, you know, wastewater systems can be linked back into water supply systems. That doesn't necessarily mean we're going to be drinking that water, but part of that circularity means linking those systems and those elements of the water cycle. But the other interesting thing that Celeste mentioned there is that cities can be generators of water as well. And in many cities, and very, very much in Australia, we have this sort of water scarcity mindset in cities, yet cities actually are water abundant because we're importing water into the city, but then we're generating this, this wastewater that we don't really use. We've significantly increased runoff generated by rainwater falling on the city because we have all of these impervious surfaces. And that abundant water is then damaging our waterways and our oceans. We've got opportunities for that water to be used in industry. We've got opportunities for that water to be used in sort of peri-urban agriculture, and that's increasingly happening here in Melbourne. But we also need to think of circularity in terms of who or what are the recipients of those services, and coming back to that, including nature in the circle. We're not treating nature as having a demand for water. So we're taking a lot of water from nature. We're depriving nature of a lot of water by draining our urban landscapes with drainage systems and stormwater systems. And as a consequence, and again, particularly in this country, you know, we had a millennium drought that ran for more than 10 years, and Melbourne, you know, it was called the Great Melbourne Brownout because basically Melbourne just turned brown and dry and pretty horrible. And that had all sorts of social impacts. We've got opportunities to use water to provide a service to nature, to meet nature's demand for water as well as part of this circularity. So as I said, you know, including nature within the circle more consciously and deliberately.
Look, you both talked about how different cities have different challenges. And so there's no one solution fix all in this context. But let's talk about a city that you both know very well, Melbourne in Australia. What do you think are the key challenges that Melbourne as a city would need to overcome if it wanted to adopt this circular approach?
Yeah, well, I think Melbourne, in some ways, it's a bit of a showcase of lots of different types of water reuse and capture. We've been working on that for a while, but we ran the numbers on Melbourne as a city and discovered we're only 9% circular. So if you take all of the water that runs off the city, only 9% of that is, you know, captured and kept in that value loop within the city. So there's still a lot of potential on top of that. But you know, for example, it's pretty common to be using recycled water to be taking that back to new homes in the growth areas for flushing toilets, etc. Rainwater tanks are, you know, around 30% of Melbourne has a rainwater tank. And we're doing a lot with agriculture, but there's still so much more potential. So I think the challenges are really to shift that mindset. Oh, as Chris mentioned, the Millennium Drought really put people in the mindset of don't use water, save the water. But now if we flip that and think of this abundance mindset, so abundance in terms of urban water availability, but also abundance in terms of the potential to drive benefits, then I think we can overcome a lot of that. And it's actually a no-brainer. It's at the moment, it's not an efficient system. We're losing too much water. We're, again, having to extract that, use desalination. If we flip that on its head, there's so much potential. And I think a lot of those challenges will also come in breaking down the kind of siloed organizations and the ways of doing things that we've set up for ourselves over time.
Well, I really agree with Celeste that the big part of the challenge is the mindset. But I think a big part of the challenge is the way we think about the solutions that we have to this sort of integrated water cycle management, integrated water management, circular water cities, and whose job it is. And at the moment, I guess we think about the water sector as being these formal water institutions, most of which are set up to manage large infrastructure systems for harvesting, you know, collecting, treating, disposing, and doing all those sorts of things. But so much of the stewardship, if I can call it that, of water in an urban landscape needs to happen at a small scale. And a lot of the instruments that are available to do that and the infrastructure to do that, it's not the large scale infrastructure, it's actually the small things that we do. It's the urban form. It's the way we design our streetscapes. And so part of the change to me is that we integrate not just the elements of the water cycle, but we actually integrate our planning and decision-making about water with our planning and decision-making about urban land use and urban form. And that this is one of the reasons why we... you know, many years ago in the stormwater management space, we were trying to shift practice from a drainage engineering approach to stormwater management, which is essentially a 19th century way of thinking. You know, you've got to drain the landscape to improve it, if you like. We wanted to introduce this concept of water-sensitive urban design, and there was argument circles at the time, and Melbourne Water and other organisations about, oh, you can't call it water sense. No one will know what you mean, and particularly coming from drainage engineers, mind you. But that was part of the point of having a different way of describing a practice as water-sensitive urban design rather than drainage engineering, because we wanted different disciplines to be part of it, to landscape architects, urban planners, ecologists, to see themselves as part of the solution to the way water is managed or stewarded in the urban landscape, and so I think that's part of it, is to sort of expand the idea of, well, whose job it is to manage water or to be part of water stewardship in the urban. It's everybody's role essentially. And what scales does it happen at? It's not just large scale infrastructure. It's actually small. It's decisions that affect the way a streetscape is designed. And we've got to sort of multiply and replicate those small things. That they're the ways we're going to transform our cities. I think it's that. So we've got to join up the big infrastructure and get that circularity. But we've actually got to change the way we do things at that smaller scale as well.
Yeah, and so you know you've talked, Celeste, a little bit about sort of future-proofing our cities, and maybe our urban plumbing wasn't designed for thinking about, you know, data centers that require so much fresh water for cooling, or like I said, green hydrogen production. And so what opportunities do you think creating this circular system might unlock for cities, especially growing cities in the space of new technology?
I think that's the beauty of a circular city approach, is that as our cities grow, so does the amount of water available, because we're creating more impermeable surfaces, creating more wastewater. So usually, you know, population growth, water scarcity, these are seen as the problems that face our cities. But if you flip that, it could actually be such an opportunity. And if we see, as you mentioned, those opportunities to think spatially about how we can integrate that water use into our cities, and whether that be new industries, as you mentioned, let's co-locate those where it makes sense, where you can harvest stormwater, where you've got a wastewater treatment plant you could put that next to. There's just a lot of efficiency in those kind of industrial co-cycles, I guess, that you could create. And there's also efficiencies in thinking about, as I said, you know, how we have productive landscapes that are close to the city, even bringing urban agriculture, you know, within our city and being more productive in our own homes and landscapes and even streetscapes to capture that water. So I think there's a really exciting opportunity to create places that we love. As Chris was talking about, if you think about that stewardship model being much more localized, communities have been so disconnected with water. And I think as humans, we have a natural relationship with water. We all love to be, you know, at the beach, by the river, connecting and feeling that. And at the moment, it just comes in as a pipe, leaves again as a pipe. All the rainfall that falls, you know, we can smell the rain. We're very sensitive to that, but it disappears. So how do we bring those personal connections back and really, you know, feel and experience water in place a lot more, rather than, yeah, hiding it underground? So I think that opportunity, which is very human, is really exciting for how we shape places in the future.
And Chris, do you think some of the opportunities might be connecting people and communities to the water cycle? I mean, you talked a little bit about even building habitats and ecosystems where nature and even trails could happen so people can walk through these spaces. Do you think that's one of the opportunities?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, thinking about place and water as part of placemaking, I think is really important, because Celeste said, you know, water is something that people connect to. And I've heard Celeste talk in the past about, you know, water brings joy to people. We tend to get a bit depressed when it rains in our cities, and we want to avoid being in the landscape. But you know, water replenishes, and even flooding. You know, we haven't really spoken much about flooding, but flooding is one of the big challenges in cities. And we talk about flooding as being a natural disaster, but if we think about flooding from a, you know, First Nations perspective, for example, which is a place where, I guess, in the water sector, where we're you know, doing a bit of work in trying to address issues of water justice for traditional owners and so on. But, you know, flood is seen as replenishing nature. So, you know, thinking about water in place and an ability to connect community, there is that opportunity to make water a more obvious part of landscape. So Melbourne is a waterway city. We've got, you know, hundreds of kilometres of waterways, and they're the principal part of our open space network. So they're highly utilised, but there are, you know, great opportunities, I think, in cities to connect people to water in the landscape, rather than thinking about our water systems are about importing water for drinking and exporting wastewater for disposal. How do we create or hold water in landscapes for nature, for amenity, for people's enjoyment? And how do people observe the water cycle themselves, that replenishment, you know, wetlands filling, birds coming, breeding cycles, those sorts of things? And there's some really good examples of that sort of work that have been happening that we could talk about as well.
Yeah, and look, you're a man who believes in connecting to his water. I believe that you had a row this morning in the Yarra River in the freezing cold. So it's nice to see you preaching what you say. So let's talk about some more practical approaches, like rowing in the river. Look, you've both been involved in some interesting water projects, and we can't share them all, but are there any favourites that you have or stories you'd like to share about a project within the water cycle that you think might help our listeners to understand more about what's going on?
Well, I can think of one, which was the repurposing of a core piece of water infrastructure in Melbourne. So across Melbourne, we have more than 200 retarding basins, which are part of flood risk management across the city. They're part of that infrastructure, the stormwater and drainage infrastructure across the city. Many of those were constructed during the 1950s and 1960s and 1970s as that post-war urban growth was accelerating across the city. And many of them were just built as, levied depressions in the ground with chain mesh fences around them and the sort of suburban household back fences onto them. And there was one we had in a particular middle ring suburb in Melbourne adjacent to a local government park called Namajira Park. And that retarding basin with the chain mesh fence and the back fences around it was repurposed into a stormwater treatment wetland. Its boundaries were expanded into Namajira Park. It was planted out as wetland habitat. So it's now accessible to the public. So it's got a trail built around it. The chain mesh fences come down, for example. So it now serves this multiple purpose, I guess, of its performance as a flood retarding basin has been enhanced because it's been enlarged, but it now also incorporates stormwater treatment, which is protecting downstream waterways. It's providing habitat for wildlife. It's providing greater amenity for the local community and recreation opportunities. And the treated stormwater from that wetland is collected and used for irrigating the active recreational areas of Namajira Reserve, so supporting the football club and so on. And so our traditional, our conventional water infrastructure has really served the city well and serves most cities very well, a safe and secure water supply, protecting public health with wastewater treatment, providing flood protection and all of those sorts of things. We can actually repurpose that and start to integrate that existing infrastructure into more place-based outcomes that reconnect people with water and connect the different elements of the water cycle as well. So that sort of work to me is a really great example, I think, of what circular water cities, integrated water management, water-sensitive cities are all about.
I love it. And helping people realise their place. And, it's not just something that happens, as you said, Celeste, a pipe that flows from one end to the other that nobody interacts with. Actually allowing people to see what the process might look like. So, Celeste, let's go pipeless and talk about your favourite project, if you have one, that you want to share with us.
It's that multifunctionality, as Chris said, that really, helps us to do many things at once and make it space efficient, I guess, in an urban context. And I guess a lot of the most exciting projects for me are grappling with how we shape out new parts of our city. So we've got new development, new housing happening in Melbourne that's usually on the edge of the city, and how we can design those new neighbourhoods in a circular way. So the circular concept we've thought about is at a city scale, but it equally applies at a development scale. So how can we think about effectively taking those developments off grid in a way, really reducing the water supply they need by capturing the stormwater and the wastewater they're creating? And there's a few great examples of this happening in Melbourne, and there's one that's just launched and in Sydney, in Western Sydney as well, called Aerotropolis, where they are building in the green infrastructure into the development. So you're seeing that water flow through the development to wetlands, like Chris described, and then harvesting that stormwater and taking it back to the homes to reuse, and really up the irrigation within our urban landscape to be using that. But then also they have a recycled water supply, so they're using the wastewater as well, actually mixing those two sources together. So you've got this abundance of water, which means that you can do more with it, but you can also support neighboring areas. So they actually become these little water generators that are pieced throughout our city, which can be a catalyst for water reuse in other parts of the city. And if we piece all those pieces of the jigsaw together, we actually have a really substantial water reuse potential within our cities. So that's exciting.
And so many connected systems, as you keep talking about. So it sort of moves us on to sort of the part of our podcast that I love, which is that you can't do everything on your own. So we call it the power of partnership, and why you have to have partnership for things to succeed in this space. So we've just heard about two amazing project stories, but I'd love to understand a little bit more about how partnership plays a role in the success of these. So Chris, I'll start with you. Do you have any examples or ideas of who needs to partner, or why partnership is important for circular water thinking?
Yeah, I think a lot of the things we've been talking about, you know, was about moving from thinking about water system services being exclusively the role of our traditional water institutions, our water utilities, the sort of the disciplines that are involved in the provision of these services are, you know, engineering, based, and it's all about large infrastructure. And if we start to think about the system operating at various scales, the different aspects of the water cycle, which tend to fall under different institutional roles, like stormwater is not traditionally a water utility role, it's a local government role, then you need the partnerships and collaboration across sectors, across the institutions to join things up. You need the joining up of functions. So land use planning and water planning need to be joined up. And you need that sort of, so you need the professions and the sectors, like local government and water services, to be joined up. And of course, it's not just about all the service providers, and to highlight, I guess, the importance of research as well, you know, understanding how to better integrate, how to get better value. I think research is a really important partner in these things, as well as we're wanting to transform practice. There's a lot of opportunity to do research, and we need to create a learning environment around these things. And I think we're working with researchers to help capture the learnings and translate new knowledge into practice. That's an important role.
Yeah, it's crucial. Celeste, power of partnership. I mean, you work at Arup, so your whole ethos is about partnership. Tell us about something that you have learned around partnership in this space.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think it is, as Chris said, it's bringing those people across the water cycle, but other disciplines into the fold as well. With Melbourne as an example, I think it's really important to highlight the shift that in governance that Melbourne's experienced, and that was enabled through shifts in policy. But they actually tried to create a new governance structure for these partnerships called the IWM Forums, which brought together over 50 organisations in Melbourne. So that's how many organisations had a role in influencing water. So it's a huge number of, you know, influences. And they got those organisations to commit to collaborating and co-funding action. So that was important, to actually invest in the same objectives rather than just their individual organisational objectives. So at a broad city scale, that's the scale of the challenge, you know, 50 plus organizations coming together to do that. And that's, you know, enabled a lot of progress. If I share a kind of smaller scale example, but I think it's an interesting one, is the one of Aquariva, which Chris mentioned, there's a lot of research input that went into that, but it also was driven by a water company who owned some land, and they decided to show how we could design with a developer to create a new kind of community. And they demonstrated a whole lot of things there. And some of the more interesting things are having both a recycled water supply to a home, but also a rainwater tank, which is smart and you know, interacts with the householder so they can see what's going on. So that smart tank can tell you when a rainstorm is coming. It can pre-empty itself so it can capture that rain and empty it itself at a time so that that water is entering the drainage system and it's not going to cause flooding because it's not going at the same time as everyone else. So those kind of systems and that interaction with communities is really interesting. And those householders, you know, received a booklet and training on how to understand all these systems in their household. And it really, you know, there's a good parallel, I guess, to the movement that's happening in the energy sector, really empowering local householders to have their own infrastructure and manage that. And I think that's the kind of partnership area we need to explore more, is how we can bring communities into this and get them to manage their own water resources, whether that be rainwater off their roof or even off their driveways, how they're using, capturing that and keeping it on their own land for their own benefit.
So what can we do? We're sort of moving into the final part of our podcast, which is, I call it the tips and tricks section, but it's sharing your insights. And maybe your insights are what some of our listeners might be able to do today to be part of this. But do you have an insight that you'd like to share for people who might be interested in the space? Maybe they work in water, maybe they don't, and they're just interested in the circular system now of our water. Chris, I'll start with you. Any top tips or tricks or insights?
Well, my big philosophical tip is look to nature. Nature's the universe's great innovator. And so I think what we can see from nature is the power of scale and time as well. And so small actions replicated over time can have a big impact. And I think sometimes we want to rush to the big solution that can be implemented immediately and then we don't have to think about it anymore. But the way we think about water in cities, we have to, this is a long-term thing. The sort of transition that we're talking about in practice is going to be a very long-term thing. But for the individual, I mean, Celeste mentioned rainwater tanks. There's things that you can do locally and in place. Rainwater tanks are a great thing to be able to do. They have multiple benefits. You get some water. You prevent water from discharging into the stormwater system and having downstream impacts. One of the programs we had at Melbourne Water many years ago was 10,000 rain gardens, and so this was just encouraging people to think about how they can use the water that falls on their place to benefit their place by, you know, disconnecting your downpipes, connecting to a rainwater tank, harvesting and using that water on your own property. And at the streetscape scale, you know, you can think about how your council, your local government, if you're getting your street remade or something, is how to use the water that's in your street to support street trees and build tree canopy cover, urban greening, mitigating urban heat, doing all those sorts of things. So I think there's a lot of ways that individuals can think about water in place and either do things on their own property where they've got some control, or try and work with others in their apartment complex or with their local government, their neighbours in the street, and, you know, do some of those little things that if replicated across the whole city can have quite a substantial impact over time.
I love it. So we can all do our little piece, a little part, and actually it could have a huge impact. Celeste, do you have a favourite tip or trick or something you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, I think I'd challenge people to contemplate that word value that we mentioned at the start. If circular cities are around retaining value and keeping things at the highest value, then ask yourself, how do you value water? Do you have a childhood memory, perhaps, of when you first connected to water? That feeling of being in nature or near water, how can we recreate that again and again in the places we live? How can we spark that joy of being connected to place, connected to water, and find those opportunities? Like, we've done a lot of work to hide water from communities. How can we bring it back to life and be really playful with that. So water runs off our roof. Can we introduce that, you know, back into playful landscapes around our homes or in our streetscapes or in our public spaces, and really treasure that, use it to nourish our landscapes, use it to nourish us, and reuse it as much as we can within our household, and just bring back, I guess, that respect and appreciation and stewardship for our water and how we live.
I love it. Oh, sadly, that's all we've got time for, but I'm going to walk away with that fact the next time it's raining, that actually this rain is going to spark joy in my life later on. Thank you for that reminder. But Chris and Celeste, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I hadn't realized before, but water has actually brought so much joy to my life. Whether it's now watching my kids splashing in puddles or just relaxing at the beach and taking a dip in the sea. And that's why the idea of circular water systems feels so powerful, not just as a solution to sustainability challenges, but as a way to protect something that is deeply human. This marks the final episode of Season 3 of Sustainable Forces. Over the past episodes, we've taken you around the world to uncover stories shaping a more sustainable future. We've dived into the complexities of Scope 3 emissions, gone behind the scenes of glass recycling, explored the promise of high-speed rail, and reimagined how our cities can be more active and inclusive. We've also celebrated climate innovation in the Pacific Islands and even questioned just how resilient our daily commutes really are. If you've enjoyed this season, make sure to leave us a review and subscribe to Sustainable Forces on your favorite streaming platform. And stay tuned because Season 4 is on the horizon. Keep an eye on Arup's channels for updates and new episodes, which are coming soon.